This podcast has been presented to you by the Scottish Oil Club, the national forum since 1975 for the presentation and discussion of views on the economic, industrial, technological and political aspects of petroleum and other energy resources. For more information about the Scottish Oil Club, see our website at www.scottishoilclub.org.uk.
Hi, this is Rob Schneider, Executive Secretary of the Scottish Oil Club. This podcast is a presentation by Dr. Richard Yem, Founder and Chief Technical Officer of Palamas Wave Power. Richard made this presentation to the Scottish Oil Club on Thursday, the 15th of November, 2007. Richard Yem.
Okay, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's always nice to address different audiences, and we do the circuit on the renewable energy conferences, but it's kind of preaching to the converted and so on. So this is obviously people from different backgrounds, so obviously delighted to be here this evening in this wonderful venue. I've got a lot of slides to get through, mainly pictures, which I thought would be fitting after you guys had a pint in the bar. I was too late. It's probably a good thing. But to set the scene, why are we doing this? Obviously, many of you will be aware of the increased focus, interest in, and opportunities within renewables as a whole. But we have some mature renewable technologies. We have wind. We have hydro. Why do we need a new one? And this is a very serious question to ask yourself. We're at the start, as I'll show you, of what will be a very long journey, a bit like yourselves in the North Sea oil and gas sector in the 70s. And we need a compelling reason to go out there and develop this new technology. It's expensive. There's lots of capital required to go and do it. The risks are high. And just like oil and gas, it's because the opportunity is high as well. Wave is one of the big renewable sources. The actual scale of the market, there's a few numbers up there, has been estimated even by the DTI, corroborated that to be in excess of $500 billion repeating. So it's a big market. It's not niche, and it obviously can make an enormous contribution to energy supply in the future. Now, it can't do it all on its own, but it is certainly on the same scale as wind, and initial markets are of the kind of scale that the early markets of wind are now currently playing into. European, North America, South America, Australia and South Africa, really the sort of developed world in the kind of 30 to 60 degrees of latitude, a bit like the wind market, the same place where the wind is where the waves are as well. First point on the slide there is that, worth noting, it's the most dense form of renewable energy. It's created by the passage of wind over the oceans, over many thousands of miles of fetch, and it's a very slow transfer of energy from wind to waves, but it's obviously got an awful lot of time to do it. And once energy is in a wave, it will travel to you without loss almost. Very efficient way of transporting energy to you at your coastline, facing the Atlantic or Pacific or Southern Oceans, and all ends up on your doorstep. So it doesn't need to be windy here and now. It doesn't need to be sunny here and now. It's as long as it's been windy somewhere, pointing roughly in your direction sometime over the last week, the energy will come to you. And that is quite a unique property of the resource. Also, because it's all that energy is stacked up in the top 50 metres, approximately 50 to 100 metres of the ocean, then it's incredibly dense. The sort of energy density within a wave is two orders of magnitude higher than in wind. Typically, the numbers on these charts here, which will be a bit fuzzy, 70 kilowatts per metre annual average. That means every stride you take along a Scottish beach on the west coast of the country has the potential to power over 70 homes. I mean, it's extraordinarily dense resource. And that's really the driver. It's a bit like burning straw. You have to burn a lot of straw to get energy. Burning oil, you get a lot of energy from burning a small amount of oil. It's the same argument for the density of the input source. So there's lots of potential for the technology to actually end up being the cheapest source of renewables. Long way to go, as you'll see in a minute. If if you look at the markets that are opening up within those, if the previous slide, you know, obviously highlighted the opportunities as being Europe, North America, South America, and Australia and South Africa. Many of these places are now looking to open up markets to encourage the technology out of the lab, if you like, and into the market. And this is a model that was very successfully used in the 80s with wind energy. The technology was just coming out, it was maturing, the machines weren't particularly reliable, they were expensive, and they weren't very efficient, but it was recognized that with the right framework, they could be. And now, 15, 20 years on, we've got an extremely impressive technology in wind turbines, very mature, costs converging, they're not there yet, but converging with conventional sources. Many would say that conventional sources may come up to meet wind energy, but that's been through very sustained, progressive introduction of feeder markets, notably in Denmark and Germany initially, then in the UK, and now Spain, the rest of Europe, and across the US. And it's really that commercial opportunity which has delivered the technology. It's a bit like oil and gas. It's the commercial opportunity of oil under the North Sea that led a bunch of harebrained engineers, maybe some of you among them, to go out there and create the technology to access it. And it's a similar driver that we need to get this into the commercial arena. And all over the Europe, US, South Africa, New Zealand, UK was last, I don't know why, we've got feeder markets springing up that are there to attract the technology out of the prototype stage, out of the pre-commercial stage, into the water. The dots on there, by the way, they're annual average wave energy in kilowatts per meter for all over the world, and you can see why the markets are springing up where they are. This is where the resource is, this is where the opportunity lies. So, we set up Ocean Power Delivery 1998, it's actually slightly terrifying, January 1998, that's almost 10 years ago. And it's been a fascinating journey to get to where we are now. It's not been an easy one so far, and I'm sure the next 10 years won't be easy either. We've had lots of trials and tribulations, we've had to raise finance, we've had to spend it and raise some more, and all the time pushing the technology towards the point that we've got to now, where we're really starting to get out into the commercial arena, starting to receive orders, lots of interest from the sector. And in doing so, we've built up and this is one of these slightly naff corporate slides, but we've built up a company which has all of the skills required to do this. You know, it's as I'm sure you'll appreciate from your sector, an extremely multidisciplinary job. We need everything from transistors to 200-ton lumps of steel, and we need to put in place a company which can deliver it competently from an engineering perspective, but also from a production and an operations side. And that's no tall order. It seems like a lot of people now, 70, but it's still the beginning, and we will be going on expanding in order to meet the challenges that we're facing. The odd OPD is going to creep in, sorry. We haven't quite made the full transition to PWP. But anyway, the PWP business model is exactly what we would expect across the power sector. There's lots of people in this new arena who are, you know, saying, oh, we'll do that entire equation on the right-hand side of the page there. But really, the kind of people we're playing with are utilities, independent power producers around the world, and what they expect is a competent piece of technology that is installed and operated in order to facilitate the rest of the chain. This is a model that is not some sort of inspirational piece of corporate development by ourselves. This is what is expected of us: a technology provider familiar in the power sector and most recently proven in the wind energy sector. We are setting up PWP to effectively be like Vestas or GE Wind or Gamesa. Lots of reasons for that. A kind of key one is, so a lot of people are saying, well, we'll prove a prototype, then we'll license it. And I think the points at the bottom left of the slide really hit home. Various people in the wind industry tried that model and failed. It's the only way to ensure quality and performance, to expand and secure the IP, which is what attracts the finance into the company. It's a very scalable model. We're not setting out to be a major fabricator. We're not setting out to be a major machinist, or indeed a major asset owner. So it's very scalable, using the supply chain, as I'll show you a little bit later, that already exists for the offshore and gas sector and the marine side. And although our investors and shareholders would very strongly refute this statement, it's got a low capital requirement with regard to the other models we could adopt. On to the technology itself. Wave energy at the moment, as I'll show you a graph of what happened in the wind industry in the 80s and 90s. But wave energy is now at its most sort of inventive, is probably the best way of saying it, phase. It could be described as a nutter's paradise. There is like everyone, every man and their dog is inventing a wave power machine, from bullocks with chains to things that are under the sea to hide from storm waves that unfortunately hide from all waves. And there's a varying degree of credibility from the quite clearly ridiculous, through the credible, nice ideas, through to a number of concepts now which are making it out into the sea and obviously have a basis, are attracting the finance and have to prove themselves now in a commercial arena. We're one of those. Just like any engineering challenge, it's a very strong belief of myself personally and indeed our whole company and investors, that we have to solve this properly at a conceptual level before throwing steel at the problem, taking technology out to sea and expecting it to survive and work as a wave energy machine. And that's really what Palamis does as a unique a marriage of both survivability and power capture efficiency. And it's a rather fortunate quirk of physics that in order to be survivable, you want to present a minimal cross-section, minimal volume to the passage of extreme waves. So you're creating something which is lined up into the storm seas that can pass us. We completely submerge, like does boot when a big wave comes along. Therefore limiting buoyancy, which limits load, but we're also presenting a minimal cross-section and a very low drag form to the extreme loading that you would experience within big seas. And it's a rather fortunate coincidence that a long, thin system moored into the waves is also an extremely effective, arguably the most effective way of deploying volume in order to capture power from the waves. Without going too deeply into the physics, you can imagine that a wave, an object in the sea, is very much like an aerial, a radio aerial. So if you bobbed it up and down, or you put some energy in it, it will radiate waves out from it into the sea. And the physicists prefer to think of the wave power machine as something which is radiating waves that cancel out the incoming waves from the sea, to leave a calm bit behind, which means the energy must have gone somewhere, so it's gone into the machine. And that's how the physicists prefer to think of it. And you can imagine that almost universally the concepts that are being developed are for a heaving buoy, like a blob that moves vertically and is restrained in that motion in order to absorb power. And it's obviously conceptually the easiest machine to think of. But if you think about how it would radiate waves, it radiates a circular pattern like throwing a stone in a pond. And it turns out that it's not very effective at a sort of, if you like, the base physics level at absorbing energy out of the sea. It's got a capture width that it can absorb, which is much less than if you take the same volume and you stretch it out into a long line. And the reason for that is that you can imagine Palamis as a whole series of individual small heaving buoys all arranged in a line, and then because of the structure, the way the joints work and the hydrodynamics and dynamics of the system, the system phases the motion of each of those little boys, have to be careful using that phrase, in order to generate a radiation pattern like a phased array radar, which is one direction. So you're putting all of this energy into the water, but it's all heading off rather conveniently in one direction. And that means that you cancel out much more of the incoming wave field without wasting all this energy going off in other directions. And that very sort of slightly obscure physics, physical principle means that the system is over 3 to 4 times the capture efficiency of putting the same amount of volume in one lump and restraining its vertical motion. And it's you know, hopefully you've kind of followed me through that, but that's a pretty fundamental operating advantage. It's I guess akin to developing a wind turbine which operates through lift, like all modern turbines, versus a turbine that operates through drag, which is like all old turbines. And you know, it's a fundamental operating principle. And it's the marriage of that with this inherently survivable form, it's a low-profile form that hides and goes underneath large waves, that makes the concept unique. However, you still have to make one. It's wonderful to write papers for scientific journals about the long, thin argument. But we need to be able to build one. And the other key principle that the technology was built on was you had to be able to build one with available technology. It couldn't rely on a piece of core technology which was new, that was some new type of electrical generator or some new type of turbine or some new type of system. And it's a very good rule in engineering is not to build prototypes within prototypes. And we've adopted that model almost exclusively. So the machine is an assembly of steel tubes, round. I've seen a few of those in your industry, with hydraulic components, which are, again, catalogue items assembled to be a unique machine, with electrical systems. A lot of technology, as you'll see, borrowed from the offshore oil and gas sector. And then critically, this independently verified point is we use the same procedures that you would use to design an offshore oil platform, to DNV's code standards recommended practices, to design this machine. So in terms of fatigue, in terms of extreme loading, in terms of factors of safety, in terms of the mooring loading, etc., we apply the same principles as are used in the offshore oil and gas sector. And we're the only team in the sector to be doing that. And indeed, we've worked now directly with DNV to start the process of writing our own codes, because we don't have 100 people sitting on top of us, and we don't have potentially very dangerous substances coming out of the ground into us. Well, not by design. The other advantages of WAVE, just to pick up on the last slide, is forecastable output. Because waves are generated as a time average process over the ocean, you sort of know what you're going to get, irrespective of what local conditions are, and that makes the system forecastable to extremely close tolerances in the next half hour to an hour, which is what's important for the electricity trading market, but also more strategically out to 24, 48 hours and with a lower degree of certainty beyond that. And that's quite unique as a renewable resource. Obviously, visual intrusion is something that you either love wind turbines or you don't. And we have the benefit that we are very much out of sight, out of mind, offshore. There's no horizon pollution. There's no visual signature at all. Very contentious point, if there are any environmental consultants in the room. Minimum environmental impact. Indeed, most people are agreed that the likely impact is positive. We've got to show that through early projects. But there's certainly no demonstrable negative impact at present. Another key feature of ourselves is the, a bit like the oil and gas sector, the lengths you go to avoid working offshore. When you're constructing your installations is unprecedented. You build entire oil platforms on shore and then tip them off barges to avoid carrying out construction activity offshore. And we are exactly the same. We bring the machine up, which is made in a factory environment, and place it on moorings, which obviously have to be installed on site. But that's a very conventional activity, just like in the oil and gas sector. And one of the key things that we're committed to is off-site maintenance. So this is taking the machine to your maintenance base rather than taking your equipment out to the site and trying to work in a dynamic environment. And there are still many companies who are saying, we'll do all the maintenance on site with divers and ROVs and people offshore. And I think anybody who has actually worked offshore would realize that is not a practical proposition. So we put a lot of effort into making the system easily installable and removable to take it to the equipment. It's a bit like taking your car to a garage rather than trying to change a gearbox on axle stands out in the road. The machine itself is composed of articulated joints between long dumb cylinders. These are just ballasted tubes. And all of the clever elements happening in the joints between the main tubes. Just to give you an idea of scale, and you'll get this from the pictures, we're talking about something that's equivalent to something like 4 train carriages, so you know, it's quite big, until it looks very small when it's out in the Atlantic. You can imagine it is a bit like 2 wind turbine towers, kind of end to end, if you've seen those. Rated power of 750 kilowatts, and depending where you put it, annual average against that of something like a quarter to 0.4. Scotland up in the north coast is about 40%, Portugal is about 25%, just based on the resource, a bit like a wind turbine. This slide here, I'll just skip through quickly, shows the principle. When the waves are small, you're very strongly coupled to the waves through hydrostatics, buoyancy, inducing the loads and motions in the joints. But when the waves get large, you start to inherently limit the loads and motions going into the system, therefore the power absorbed, and in extreme waves, the loading and motion of the joints. I'll get away from these boring graphics in a minute. The power takeoff system is within the short sections between the long ones. It's like the engine room of the system, which has 3. And this is just a conventional hydraulic system running backwards, if you like. So it's like very equivalent to taking the arm of a JCB and wiggling it, and it pumping oil into an accumulator to drive a generator, rather than the diesel driving a pump to pump into an accumulator to drive the arm of the excavator. It's all the same components. As you can imagine, to get to where we are today, we've been through a pretty tortuous, long and involved development program. And I think, again, this is something that the rest of the sector really needs to heed. You need to go through these steps of plenty of primary work, preparing, understanding the concept, developing the basis for the machine, proving it at a conceptual level. In our case, we did it at 7th scale in the 4th. With a fully functional machine, apart from the watts, if you like, that was out in the 4th. Then go into a heavy-duty development program to prove the technology at full scale. We built a, very much like a lot of systems in the oil and gas sector, we built a full-scale model of the full-scale system in the lab with some external rams, the yellow rams you can see on the picture in the bottom left, to pretend to be the ocean, to shove it around and work out why it wasn't going to work. And we had lots of learning from that before proceeding to the full-scale prototype machine, which we've been working with up in Orkney for the last couple of years. And I think probably the program is best described as from this. This is in the old wave tank that is now a bunch of offices for computer science students in the university, to this, which is the real machine actually out in the ocean doing its job. Probably worth a sort of quick pictorial skip. I'm not sure if this is going to work, but this is our. This is normally played to Benny Hill music. This is we've just been doing some changing the mooring attachment and disconnection system. It's wonderful watching the boats in the background. It's like something out of the Magic Roundabout when they sort of move around. But this is a sort of a time-lapse photography. This is actually an Imperial dock down in Leith. We do most of our stuff down in Leith. And this is the machine just before it went back up to Orkney earlier this year after a series of upgrades. We've used it as a platform to keep the technology learning and moving. And one of the main things we did here was, you can see at the end front of the machine, there's a yoke for attachment and detachment from the moorings, and that's a hands-free kind of very much based on the same kind of thing as you use the stab plate in the offshore oil and gas sector to plug in the connectors and mechanically connect the machine without anybody being anywhere near it. So your offshore operations are join two ropes together and go away, and the machine installs itself. And then to remove it, you remotely press a button and drive off. You know, kind of investment that we need to make in the technology in order to make it operable, and I'll come back to that shortly. This is the machine out on sea trials, just out past the Isle of May. It's an extremely useful format. People always say when you go to full scale, you can't choose your conditions. But we've developed this technique, which is testing the machine between two vessels out in the North Sea, under tow, but with a pretend mooring system hanging beneath it. So the machine is responding in exactly the way it would do on site. But the thing that the marketing department don't like is the umbilical, of course, which comes back to the support vessel for testing. But you can see in the kind of pictures that we've got that we can actually go out and give the machine a very robust test without actually sticking it out on the sea. And it's a bit like sort of test flying an aircraft. And this is, hopefully you don't all get seasick when you're watching this. But this is, you know, extremely realistic. I think the machine's absorbing about 200 kilowatts in these waves. You can't go out in conditions where you'd be at full power, but it allows you to completely commission and debug the machine in terms of its operations software, etc., as if it was operating on moorings. On to the kind of work that we've been doing in order to prove and improve the technology over the last kind of couple of years. We've been working up at the European Marine Energy Centre in Orkney, which was built essentially specifically for ourselves, but now being used by other people as well. And to give you an idea of the problem that we have, and this again is very much a common issue in the offshore oil and gas sector, is we have to be able to operate in an inherently aggressive place. We don't want to put a wave energy machine in the middle of the Firth of Forth so it's easy to operate because it won't absorb any power. We've got to get real on the statistics of working in the Atlantic Ocean, west of Orkney, west of Shetland. And these are the kind of statistics that we're looking at. These graphs here are the probability of getting a weather window of a certain length for 1, 2, 3, and 4 meter significant wave height. That's the sort of average wave height in a given period. And this is the same plot for summer. And what it really shows you is that if you want to get onto machines, if you need to get onto them to install mooring lines and to carry out maintenance, you're not going to do that in more than 1 meter significant wave height. If you look at the kind of manned access of single point mooring buoys, all of these kind of elements, you're right down in that threshold. It's a summer activity. And even then, if you can't do it quickly, you're still in trouble. So if you need a period of days to carry out an operation with manned intervention in the splash zone, you just can't do it. So you've got to be a bit cleverer. And really what we're targeting is for the first generation of technology is to be able to work in 2 meter significant wave height. And I'll show you some bits and pieces. And we've nearly proven all of our operations in that now with small vessels. But ultimately, if we can push the next generation out to 3 meters significant wave height, which is approximately the height of the picture rail here, so reasonable lumps of water flying around, the biggest ones would be about 5 meters high, then we're really into the zone where the seasons don't play too big a part in our operation. Sorry, to add to that, and we can do things quickly, less than 6 hours in this case, then we do have an opportunity to work. We started out using, in the heady days of 2004, and absolutely no interest whatsoever in anchor handlers. We started using a lot of anchor handlers for what seems like a lot of money, £4,000 or £5,000 a day. But at the end of 2004, into 2005, the North Sea market started heating up again. A lot of boats had gone off on long-term contracts, and the price suddenly went up to £130,000 per day. So again, necessity is the mother of invention, and we had to go off and create and engineer a system that can use much smaller vessels like these boats here, which are the new general-purpose workboat type, which is called a multi-cat for multi-category. And they're basically, as you can see, make no concessions to hydrodynamics whatsoever, but they're kitted out with the tools that we need: deck cranes, winches, rollers, good visibility from the bridge, safe working environment. And they command a day rate of about £2,000 a day, and it's not volatile in the same way that the anchor handler market is. They also only burn about 3 tons of fuel a day instead of 30, which is obviously quite important for our carbon footprint. So, having got the prototype machine up to Orkney, in the case this year, back up to Orkney after all of the work on the connection-disconnection system to prove it, we returned to our Salubrious operations base, which is the old disused naval base at Line S on Hoy. You can see it's very well kitted out. We've changed a ram there, we've changed an accumulator there, we've completely emptied, refilled hydraulic circuits and so on there. And it's been a good proof of the pudding, if you like, in terms of being able to operate with minimalist facilities and complete quite complex operations. We then tow out to site. This is part of the installation system that attaches the machine to the moorings. And there we are on site, and it's quite the old man Ahoy is watching over, no doubt with amusement, our antics on the site in terms of installing. The machine, when it's on site, is connected through power and fibre optic umbilicals back to the control room. It's very much like any power station, any offshore installation, in fact, as well, and where we can monitor it, control it, and diagnose any problems we have, all remotely in the comfort of an office in Stromness. And this is really the basis for which a wave farm would be controlled in the future. And part of the testing we did this year was to confirm that for 48 hours we could monitor and operate the machine from our office here in Edinburgh. And we're rather fortunate that network, wireless comms, virtual private networks and so on, that technology has all developed in the last 10 years as well. And we're very much utilising it. We're hoping in the future we don't need fibre optics. It's all going to be wireless. So this is the machine on site. It's seen from the beach. It's 2 kilometres offshore. It's quite shallow water. Normally we would be further offshore. We've got lots of nice pictures of it in operation. We had a flypast from the Air Force here. We were slightly worried it was going to be a bombing run, but fortunately nothing fell off it. And then, obviously, to the machine actually working. And now, obviously, to get out and take pictures, you need the conditions to be reasonably benign. And this was, I guess, about a 1.5 metre swell. But the machine's still operating and absorbing around about 150, 200 kilowatts. And then you retreat to the safety of a cliff top to take pictures in rougher weather. And this is with the machine up, absorbing about 400 kilowatts in about 3 to 4 metres significant wave height. And you can see that, again, all of those principles that I talked about before, the sort of local submergence, which limits the joint angles and motions, and therefore power absorbed, going on. Don't know what that slide was. Now, I did have a nice bit of video to show you, but unfortunately, through the wonders of Microsoft, you can't put a Microsoft Windows Media Player video, that one anyway, into a Microsoft PowerPoint presentation. I'll maybe show you later on the screen. Then to removal, what we have is a floating line off the rear of the machine, which we can pick up, attach to the removal vessel, and then purely through pressing buttons through a wireless link, release the machine to tow it to shore. And this is recovering in 2.5 metres significant, so we've exceeded our targets here. And the whole process takes about 10 minutes. So you basically drive up one boat, pick up a slack floating line, attach it to a weighted tow line off the back of the boat, which takes about a minute, get yourself stable on heading, go through something which is akin to launching a nuclear missile of 2 keys and all kinds of passwords and encrypted signals, and release the machine and tow away. And it's really that kind of system which is going to make this a credible, viable technology going forward. No climbing on, undoing shackles and pins under load and so on. This is all remotely operated. So in terms of where we've got to with operations, we've proven pretty much everything we wanted to prove on the operational side, apart from, of course, you can't do it with one machine, let alone a prototype, the long-term maintenance strategy and cost. We've got lots of models for what the economics of the system in terms of O&M costs, availability, etc. are, and reliability models. But obviously that is the part that is the role of the next stage, which is the small initial projects and the scale-up of that to prove. It's probably worth highlighting that there's lots of people now in the offshore wind sector who are looking at us and the way that we've implemented our technology and going, we need to do that kind of thing, which is redundancy. I mean, you have this in the oil and gas sector as well. Obviously, downtime is extremely expensive, particularly if you can't access the machine. And the offshore wind sector is currently struggling with availability 70-80%. Because of access to the turbines. With an onshore turbine, you don't really need redundant systems because it's very quick to whiz up in your Land Rover and reset a breaker or change a minor component and get the machine running again. But that's just not true offshore. And offshore turbines are essentially marinized onshore turbines, and they're now very much looking to have redundant pitch drives, redundant electrical systems, so that they can increase their availability. That's all very much designed into this machine. Start with. It's designed to fail gracefully, designed to progressively reduce its ability to absorb power without compromising it completely. Very few single point failures in the system. Now I want to skip through some brief pictures of manufacturing. We've fully utilised the offshore oil and gas sector for this. There's very few of our suppliers don't work in the oil and gas sector as well. And this is the power modules being made at Ross Deep Tech in Stonehaven. This is the finished unit being shipped down to our facility in Methil in Fife. This is the modules for the three Portuguese machines that we put together there. Very much like a wind turbine, you have pilot components all been through their QA checks that get loaded into the module, commissioned, and then we ship that as a unit through to Portugal. The main tubes, very much like wind turbines or offshore fabrication, these actually were made out of the yard in Arnish, in Lewis, but that could equally be any fabrication shed around Scotland. Lots of these are cast nodes welded into the main tubes. These are the noses of the system themselves, where the mooring yoke goes through, and then these are the finished units being loaded onto a ship to be shipped over to Portugal, where we've completed, that's Nicol Stephen, who came out to visit. We completed the assembly of the three machines prior to the work trials we've just been doing. We've also tried very hard to prove a lot of enabling technology here. You know, we don't want to, you saw the lovely video of the dry dock, but obviously there won't be dry docks available where we want to take these machines. We have to have systems that allow us to do all of the operations we need at a remote site like Lyoness. So we've developed this system, which is called the Habitat, which is a little portable dry dock that can be moved along the machine, attached, sealed, and pumped dry to allow you to work on the joint without actually having to take the machine to a large dry dock facility. And it's proved extremely effective in use, and we're making a number more for the next stage of the project. And that's all certified to DNV, so it's all kind of certified, safe, insured, and as a confined space working environment. This is the three machines. We're just about to take this one out on a sea trial. Two more in the background here. So you can start to see the kind of nature of the operation. It's going a little bit beyond the kind of prototype, madman on a budget type stage, and we're actually now into the beginnings of commercial operation. This is us taking one of them out through from Penisharba to tow it up to La Choiche just the other week. So in terms of the manufacturing side, now we've done a lot of things right, but we obviously have not proven volume manufacturing techniques. We've actually made quite a lot of mistakes along the way, and that's obviously why we have to scale up and do this steadily. We can't just suddenly make 1,000 of these and take over the world. We are learning about the critical QA process, safety, etc. issues with our process. But again, we're significantly ahead of the competition in this regard. These are really the only four real wave power machines in existence. in the world. Critically, I want to skip through a bit on costs and cost reduction, because that's the first question, so best preempt it, with the technology. Now, this is a very typical development cycle for any technology. You start out with your 10 millimeter thick steel and your small hydraulic rams and your very simple models, thinking, hey, this is just amazing. It's so cheap, and we've just got to go out and do it, which is where we started 10 years ago. Then through a series of reality checks, and you start marching inexorably up the cost curve, and it gets a bit depressing after a while. But fortunately, you press on, and we've now think that we're the only people in the sector who really have established a first-of-kind cost. We've built four machines. We've learnt a lot of things along the way, which have meant that the costs are higher than we anticipated when we started, but we certainly have established the first-of-kind cost. From here, hopefully, I'm sure there will be some small steps up, but from here, really we're into a phase where we're in the rapid learning stage of the technology. We can drive out cost, we can improve performance through a mixture of learning by doing and learning by searching. There's still an awful lot we need to get right with this machine before it matures. And if you look at wind turbines 20 years ago, compared to now, if you look at your kind of drilling technology, I'm sure if you put the subsea drilling technology on a curve like this, it would probably make it up to the crest above the stage. And it's a cycle that everything goes through. Wind energy is probably somewhere in its normal learning curve now, so it's sort of stabilizing cost reductions. The small gas turbines are out in their extended learning phase. Unfortunately, as you march forward, the amount of money you need to make these kind of steps grows exponentially, while the risk only comes down rather more slowly. And we're now in this quite challenging phase where the risks are still high, but the quanta of finance we need to proceed is growing steeply. And I said that it's been an interesting journey for the last 10 years. We're currently in this phase persuading customers, persuading utilities to part with capital with a risk profile that they're not used to. Fortunately, it's quite a sexy thing for them to be doing, so they're all very keen. Looking at where we're sitting with regard to other technologies starting out, our opening costs are up around about £2.5 to £3 million per megawatt. That's pretty expensive for the technology where we are. But if you put that on a plot of how other technologies have got on through their development cycle, then you're seeing we're not actually doing too bad at all. Considering we've made four machines, wind energy started up at around about £5,000 a kilowatt. Solar voltaics is just about getting down to £5,000 a kilowatt, and we're starting out 2.5 to 3. So it's quite an encouraging start in terms of the future potential of the system. And if you stick that on, you can tell that this slide came from the marketing department, by the way. Everything slides around. It's quite groovy, isn't it? I have to learn how to do that. You can see that if you put everything into the cost, then again we're coming out around about half where wind energy started. Still extremely expensive, high teens, 20 pence per kilowatt hour. It's just people think, well, why are you doing this? But because of the technology learning cycle, we're actually very encouraged that we're starting out at a good initial point. I mentioned consolidation of the industry. This is a slightly sort of ropey looking plot of what's happened with the wind industry. We had until 1985 there were small companies doing this. There was small turbines, 100 kilowatt single units, no big wind farms. But through the 80s and 90s, that has consolidated down to the fact that we now have a few large players. In fact, it's really consolidating out to four or five major manufacturers who are making big machines in quantity to be installed in large arrays. And that goes along with installed capacity. We can't just jump to this stage. We're going to have to go through a similar cycle to get credibility for the technology, financeability, get debt into projects, get performance guarantees that are believed, in order to get to the stage. And along that way, a lot of the ideas will fall away, and quite rightly, it'll end up being a survival of the fittest, with the laws of nature being the laws of finance, and we'll end up with a consolidated industry with I believe one winning concept. Just looking at the process in some more detail, I mentioned two processes, learning by searching and the other one learning by doing. Early in the life of a technology, innovation plays a huge part. You are looking at the machine, you're learning about it, you know, you increase the efficiency of the power takeoff system, you learn about control, about dynamics, and about the application of those in the system. But you also do learn by through doing, through actually operating, through manufacturing, through installing and removing. But initially, innovation is going to play a big role, and then when we get out to the later stages of the cycle, then learning by doing will take over. And I always like to show, because people somehow don't believe that this process operates, everyone's got a snapshot of the cost of where the technologies they use today are, and say, how can you possibly reduce that cost by 60-70%? Through what you're doing, and wind energy has just done that in the last 15 to 20 years. It's reduced its cost by 80% in 15 years in terms of delivered energy, and it's done so through a mixture of upscaling, so making better use of installation costs, improved technical efficiency with aerodynamics, with control, with gearboxes, through staged introduction. I quite like this plot, staged introduction of innovation to allow the learning by doing part to operate. And this is the product life cycle of each of the different classes of wind turbine in the Danish market over the last 20 years. And you can see that a variant will come into manufacture, peak, and then be phased out as the next machine takes over. So it's not changing something every time you do it, it's introducing innovation in a controlled way. And that results in that same step-slope cost reduction curve, that whereby you are, through a mixture of innovation and standardization, progressively driving out the cost of the system. And we, of course, have got our equivalent models, starting up with the prototype units, the four units up here, very too expensive. The next generation, which we're about to start building, down in the sort of 2.5 million per megawatt. Then looking at our initial target, which is about 1.5 million, which is where offshore wind is today. And with that comes a cost of energy curve. Again, with our initial target to get down to the sort of high single figures of pence per kilowatt hour, which is where offshore wind is, ultimately closing the gap, hopefully middle of the next decade, with onshore wind and thereafter conventional sources. But it's a challenging process. 10 years to close the gap on mature renewables is going to be another interesting 10 years. Just to show you what's actually going on, we're nearly through the presentation. We're working with a number of key people. What we want to do is want our initial customers to be people who've got an appetite for this in the longer term, who want to scale up, who want to create installations of a significant size where we can prove the long-term economics of the system. We don't want to do 30 one-machine projects dotted around the world. We'd far rather do one 30-machine project and thereby achieve the economies of scale and make the whole job resourceable. And the first people to step into the frame were a renewable developer, the biggest renewable developer in Portugal, called Grupo Enersys, who are now owned by Babcock & Brown. And they've commissioned a three-machine project, which I'll show you a little detail of in a minute, off the northern coast of Portugal, which is the one that we're currently installing. Scottish Power is pushing ahead with, or Iberdrola, whichever you care to choose, is pushing ahead with a four-machine project up at EMEC in Orkney, and we're currently finalising contracts for that. Hopefully get that away early in the new year. E.ON, working with a small renewable developer called Ocean Prospects, Wind Prospect, who've done lots of wind farms, are working on a seven-machine project in Cornwall at a facility that's currently being about to start being constructed in called the Wave Hub, which is a sort of a leased grid connection which you can use. We're working with Norvento, which is one, I think, the second largest renewable developer in Galicia in terms of the Spanish markets. We have an MOU with them, and we're again hoping to proceed to a pilot contract during the course of next year. And Chevron have started to get interested in the sector, as are a number of the oil companies. One of our main shareholders is Statoil. And they are seeing this as, hang on, this is a renewable technology where we perhaps have more to offer the technology than onshore wind. And there are more synergies with the kind of stuff we do already, and it's good to see them coming forward. The first project is up in Agusadora in the northern part of Portugal. Three machines, 2.25 megawatts. I showed you the pictures of those machines being built. Surveys, completed for the second phase, which is a 20 megawatt scale up, which probably won't be done in one go, but maybe two stages over the next 2 to 3 years in order to achieve a project of scale and therefore start cementing the long-term operating costs. And they're currently in a slightly terrifying phase of trying to negotiate a framework deal with the Portuguese government and a couple of partners we have there for a 500 megawatt program over 10 years. So it's really kind of kicking off, and there's an enormous enthusiasm in Portugal for this, because they have, a bit like the UK, have installed lots of wind energy, but they're not making any of it. They're not seeing any financial return to the country through manufacturing. And so they have done a foresighting exercise on what the new technologies are that are coming forward, what their resources are, what their skills are, and they've concluded that they've really got to go for wave in a big way. Hence the kind of programs that the Danish government committed to get wind energy going, a staged, stepped tariff reduction program to get us through the steep part of that learning curve I showed you before. Scottish Power project up in Orkney at EMEC, just off the mainland in Orkney, has got most of its approvals, in fact I think all of its approvals in place. The Section 36 was granted about a month ago, and we're now proceeding towards finalising the contract to get that on the go next year. And then I mentioned E.ON, who've got a dedicated marine renewables team, who are looking to do a tidal project and a wave project in the next year or two, and we are the selected wave project, and we're advancing the seven machine scheme at the wave hub in Cornwall. Quite sure what's happened to that graphic. The exclusion zone doesn't appear to be in the right place. So in summary, we've got a major global market. It's a potentially enormous opportunity here if we can get the technology to the point that it is competitive economically with conventional sources and existing renewables. Because we are making progress, and it's really people seeing the images of real machines in the water rather than graphics in a university paper, is leading to the kind of feeder markets we need to get us into the water, to get projects of scale and start reducing the costs to a competitive level. I think that even speaking to our competitors, few would deny that we're in perhaps the enviable, perhaps not enviable position of being the leading technology at the moment. And we're certainly the only technology that is independently verified in terms of its robustness for use in the marine environment. And I guess that independently verified covers rather arrogantly, a number of independent reviews of the sector that have been done as well, which have all concluded that we have the best prospects in terms of the long-term economics, but also we're the most advanced in terms of the program. And I guess it has been a bit of a story of the tortoise and the hare. We set out knowing that we had to do, it's taken a little bit longer, a little bit more money than we originally envisaged, but set out knowing that we had to bite off the development program in a series of stages without just rushing to sea with the promise of electricity that was too cheap to meter, familiar quote. The result of that is that we've actually ended up in the lead, because everyone else has come and gone, or has stuttered, or has died, and reborn with new investment, etc. And I think that's a model we're determined to keep. It would be very easy here to try and sell 500 machines based on technology that is partially proven, but that would be your undoing, and there are plenty of cases of that across all sectors. We've got the IP very solidly wrapped up, which our investors love. The costs are understood, and we have a very focused program working with a number of partners to get the cost out of the system. For example, if we made the main tubes out of concrete, post-tension concrete, working with Arup on this, the cost is estimated to be about one-third of what the equivalent steel structure. Because it's a fatigue-intensive structure, concrete is particularly attractive compared to steel. The model we've chosen, really the investment community has been the judge of that, is we believe, the correct model. The business plan is based on achievable growth, as I said to you before. There's no point in promising the earth and failing to deliver. We've been very careful not to do that, and I think this is why people keep investing in us. And we have progressively acquired, we've still got some way to go, but progressively acquired the skills and expertise to deliver this. Now, that's not to say we've made lots of mistakes along the way, though we haven't made lots of mistakes along the way, we have. But we've had the expertise to solve them, to move on, and to progress. And I think that it should speak volumes. I think the next largest wave power company has 15 employees, and the next one below that has 5. And we have 70 people. It's an expensive old animal, but you need it to do this. It's still we still struggle to have the resources to deliver what we're trying to do with 70. We've got the first sales contract signed, and that's arguably the only one in the sector. There is one of our competitors does have an agreement to build a project that the customer may subsequently buy, but that's obviously something slightly different. And we have an onward sales pipeline building. There is a kind of critical mass emerging. The diligence processes are getting easier. The belief equation, if you like, has been solved, and now we're into the domain of persuading people that they want to get into the sector at the ground floor to learn about it, so that they can scale up with us over the coming years. So, just in summary, it's exciting times. It's been an interesting road getting here. Not entirely what I expected, but and I'm sure that will be the case going forward. But it's a very exciting time to be involved in this new sector in renewables. And hopefully the talk has been of interest to people from a different background and walk of life.
Thank you for listening to the Scottish Oil Club podcast. For more information about the Scottish Oil Club, see our website at www.scottishoilclub.org.uk.